speaker tonight is TJ.
Thank you. Hi, family. My name's TJ, and I'm an alcoholic. And my home group is the Spiritual Solutions meeting in Sag Harbor. And until tonight, I used to think it was the best meeting on the eastern end of the U.S. I said, until tonight, this is quite a meeting. This is amazing. There's a lot of people here. I'm sober 19 years. A little over 19 years ago, I remember my sixth night down in the basement of this very building. It was the Midtown meeting. It was my first Thirsty Thursday. And I thought if I could just get through this Thursday night and get a week, there might be hope for me. And I remember there was a speaker, and then they broke into groups. And I remember being at a table, and I was pounding the table with my fear of drinking. It was like I was holding my seat in the chair, afraid that I was going to run out and drink. And I didn't. I remember, though, as I was pounding, somebody at the next table kind of looking over at me, concerned. And then some people from that meeting took me over to the 79th Street Workshop. And then from that meeting, I think we got a bite to eat at a diner, and then we went to the midnight meeting in Times Square. And I had done I'd gone to the mustard seed meeting before I went to the meeting in the basement here. So by 1 o'clock in the morning, I was pretty exhausted, and I went home. And I remember when I woke up the next morning, I said, yes, I made it, a week. You know, I couldn't wait to get to a meeting and get my seven-day applause. Those applauses meant a lot to me. You know, I come from a very long line of alcoholics, and I've heard people say that, you know, alcoholism's genetic. I've heard people say it's environmental. In either case, I was set up from the very beginning. My father was an alcoholic. His mother was an alcoholic. On my mother's side, my grandmother had seven brothers and seven sisters, big Irish family. Every single one of them died from alcoholism. So I was set up before I picked up my first drink. All the alcoholic attitudes were laid down for me. My family has a long history of alcoholism and a long history of trouble with the law. You know, a lot of petty crimes. My grandfather had done time in a reform school. My father had done time in a reform school. My older brother had done time in a reform school. And I, like the rest of my family, I kind of went in the family business, you know? It's not like we were an organized crime family. If anything, we were a disorganized crime family. It was a lot of pathetic stuff. And a lot of my trouble was always around drinking. I was 17, and I'd already lost my driver's license. In fact, I remember when the cop pulled me over and he asked me for my license, I handed him my paper license. You know, you got your paper license and the picture license would come in the mail. And I remember he just looked at me and thought, ugh. And I lost my license. I was one of those kids that always got caught for everything I ever did. You know, as a friend of mine from Brooklyn said, you know, I was always the cockroach in the middle of the kitchen when somebody turned the light on. You know? I never should have done anything wrong. I was at a party, and I had a few drinks, and I was walking home. And as I was walking home, I found this toy gun in a field. And, you know, I picked it up, and I was playing with it, and I was twirling it around my finger and sticking it in my pocket. You know, I was kind of an immature 17-year-old. If somebody had seen me doing it, I would have stopped, you know? I was kind of at that age. And as I walked through the parking lot of this Farmer Jack's, I grew up in the Midwest, there was one of those photo mat booths, you know, the places where you drive up and drop your film off and come back and get it the next day. And I walked up to the window with the little toy gun and stuck it in the window, and I said, your money or your life, or, you know, something really stupid like that. And the woman turned, and she scooped out $50 from the cash register. And I grabbed it, and I ran home, and I got caught. It didn't matter that it was a toy gun, and the judge wasn't amused. And I got sent to an adult prison at 17 years old for 4.5 to 15 years. So my consequences for my drinking and behavior hit early. On my first day when I was in prison, there were some older inmates befriended me, and they said, "Do you drink, kid?" I said, "Oh, like a fish," you know, which fish is what they called new inmates as well, you know. And he says, "Well, we make our own liquor here. You know, we make spud juice. Some prisons call it Pruno." And I thought, oh, boy, I'll get through this time real fast. And so I sat down with these guys, and I had a drink. And it was nasty. It was like, oof. I just can't even begin to tell you what it tasted like, but that warmth started to come up from the first drink. And at a certain point, I had turned my head, and out of the corner of my eye, I saw the guys refilling my glass. I thought, well, they just think it's cute, you know, getting the young fish drunk, you know. So I kept turning my head, you know. I was young and naive, and you know, I'm an alcoholic. I couldn't see beyond the drink. I couldn't see what was coming. What I didn't know was these guys spiked my drink with Thorazine, which is a heavy sedative they gave the mentally ill prisoners. And then I was lured down the hall and gang raped. And when the guys were done, they literally flipped a coin in the air to decide which of them would own me. And I became the property of another inmate. Needless to say, while I was in there, every opportunity that I got to drink or to drug, I did. Because I didn't want to be there. I wanted to check out. I didn't want to feel, and I didn't want to experience. And, you know, there was no escape other than alcohol. I got out of prison at 21, literally got out of prison on a Monday, and I flew to New York on a Friday. I wanted to put as much a distance between me and that world as I possibly could. I even changed my name on the plane. What I learned in these rooms years later, though, is that the problem with a geographic is that you take you with you. And I brought my demons with me, and as much as I tried to outrun them, they were right behind me the whole time. And I drank, and I checked out as much as I could. But I'll tell you this, I was never going to do anything that was going to get me landed back in prison again. That much was sure, was certain. But I loved New York. New York offered a lot of anonymity. You know, it was a new world. You know, nobody knew me. I didn't have that past to overcome, and I was young enough. I was 21. And I remember when I arrived here, there was someone I met who told me, "Oh, New York's great. You know, the bars are open until 4 a.m., then there's the after-hours clubs." And whenever I talked to anybody back home, and they'd say, "How's New York?" it'd be the first thing I'd say. "The bars are open until 4 a.m., and there's after-hours clubs. They're legal. The bars are only open until 2 in Detroit." I love that. There was work here, you know, and I got work here, and I stayed out of trouble, but every opportunity I got, I drank. I stumbled into the New York City Transit Authority. And in fact, when I got sober, I came into AA at 27. And in fact, that next morning when I woke up and went to work, that was the first five-day work week I had put in about 2 months. I was this close from getting fired from the New York City Transit Authority. You all live in New York. You have any idea how bad you got to be that close to getting fired? I was out of control, you know? And my magic wasn't working for me anymore. My world was very small. My world was very isolated. That film, what's that movie? I See Dead People. Sixth Sense. You remember the kid sees ghosts, you know, but at a certain point in the film, he kind of stops and he turns around and he goes back into the tent where there's a ghost, and he sits down and he says, "Okay, do you have something you want to tell me?" That's kind of what happened to me almost from the moment I walked into AA. You know, I'd been running, you know, my whole life, it seemed, but certainly from 21 to 27, I'm going to skip here because, you know, I just, you know, we've heard the stories before. Bright lights, big city, I found drugs that enabled my drinking, and, You know, all those days that I would miss work and the promises I'd make to myself at 8 o'clock in the morning as I was crashing, God, get me through this and I'll never do it again. And, you know, the trips to the ATM to get more cash and, you know, the credit card debt up to here. And my world had been reduced to being in a sex club at, you know, 6 in the morning alone with an empty bottle, you know, and then I would stagger home. So I staggered into these rooms. I staggered into the mustard seed, and I felt like I was sliding off of a roof, and I couldn't hold on anymore, and I wanted to let go. And, you know, where I started, I'd rather die than go back there. So AA was my last choice, or my last chance. And I staggered in, and, you know, the people in the rooms embraced me. You know, they said, you know, you're in the right place. You know, come early and stay late. Sit in the front row. Raise your hand and share your day count. Don't leave before the miracle happens. Get a sponsor, someone who's got what you want, and do what he did to get what he's got, what he has. The men stick with the men, and the women stick with the women. You know, all the lessons that I learned in these rooms were almost the exact opposite of the lessons that I learned growing up, you know, and I had been living my life by. And there was hope. I don't know for what. It just, if it was nothing else than to, you know, avoid going back to where I had been. But I took the suggestions, and my life started to change almost immediately. I had a sponsor in the software business, and, you know, they said, you know, find someone who's got what you want and do what they did. He had a duplex apartment with a garden apartment. You know, I remember being in his apartment once and looking around going, God, if I do what you did, could I get what you got, you think? Maybe? You know. I went to college in recovery, and I got my bachelor's degree at St. Francis College, which was around the corner from my home group at the time. When I graduated, there were 26 people in the balcony from my home group who came to watch me get my diploma. And they held a meeting up there. Graduations can be pretty pretty boring, you know, waiting until the one person you know out of hundreds gets up and walks across the stage. So they held a meeting about showing up for each other. And my sponsor had a party for me after that. And, you know, I did what my sponsor did, and I stumbled into the software business, and I did it at a time that was great to get into that business. And, you know, my world changed, you know, on the outside. I did my, I did the steps, and I remember when I got done doing the my fifth step with my sponsor, he said to me, you know, TJ, you might want to consider therapy. You know, I said, you think? He says, well, you got one or two things in your background that, you know, you might benefit from that. I used to hang out a lot at the diner in Brooklyn Heights, where all the people after the meeting would go. And I remember being there that one night with a lot of my friends that I counted days with and that. And I said, you know, my sponsor said I should maybe go to therapy. You think I need it? And everybody at the table's head just vigorously went up and down, you know? I said, oh, okay. You know, I wasn't ready to talk about any of my stuff, really. I mean, it was a big deal for me to share what I shared with my sponsor in my fifth step. But I felt this enormous relief in doing it. You know, I'd been carrying this burden around. I'd been carrying these secrets around with me. Things that I thought I would never tell another soul. They'd go to my grave with me. You know, what happened in there stayed in there. And I think even with my sponsor, I sort of just danced around it a little bit. But I probably shared enough with him for him to know that enough of to get a glimpse of what it was like for me in there. And I, you know, for many of us, we need other things. We need help outside the steps, but the steps were certainly a huge catalyst for me to begin the real work of recovery. And even the word recovery, I think that, You know, I learned a whole new life in these rooms. And the program opened up possibilities for my life that I wouldn't have had. You know, I think it's a miracle that I've even lived this long, frankly. I wanted to die. The way that I was drinking and doing other things, I think I've heard somebody say in the rooms once, I was doing suicide on the installment plan. You know, I lacked the nerve to just do it directly, you know. And in here, I was taught to, you know, face my demons and to recover from it. I know the first time having gone through the steps, doing the fourth and the fifth step, I remember there were times, even without getting to the really heavy stuff with my sponsor, my face burning when I would share some of the things that I had done, you know. And I had a great sponsor that would say, I've done that, you know. All through the way, he was like, yeah, I've done that too. You know, and each time he did that, I would feel a little less unique, you know, a little less different, a little less terminally unique, I guess, you know, a little more human. The sixth and the seventh step took a couple times through, and I'm still working on that. My character defects reveal themselves to me in layers, and I still have work to do there, but the eighth and the ninth step, the making the list of people that I owed amends to was so important, you know, to take that action and to try to make right. And in some cases, the best amends I could do was to stay out of somebody's life, you know. Each time I did one of those things, it sort of made me feel a little more human, a little less unique. I started to give myself a little bit of a break. It was about learning how to be comfortable in my own skin 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. It was about learning how to be able to look people in the eye, which I couldn't do. I still use that as a gauge for how I'm working my program. If I'm finding that I'm looking down a lot and I can't look people in the eyes, it's sort of, I'm like, okay, what's going on here? You know, why am I isolating? My disease wants me alone and it wants me dead. But I did that work in my, and I continue to do that work. I continue to do service. I had a problem at a certain point in my sobriety because things were going so great that, you know, when I was living in the material world, we talk about, you know, this being a bridge back to life. I had a period where things were so great I couldn't make meetings because I was so busy, you know. I had a big job, and I had a place in the city and a house in the country, and, you know, my partner and I adopted a daughter, and, you know, I was juggling all these things, and I get to one meeting a week, and, you know, and all of a sudden my attitudes were all over the place. I'd find out I was, you know, blowing up at a hotel clerk, you know, or at a car rental reservationist, you know, the very thing that had given me this life. I've heard people say that anything you put in front of your sobriety, you'll lose. And I have stayed sober for all this time, but I've not drank or drugged, I should say. But I haven't stayed sober. There was a period there where I wasn't sober. I hadn't picked up, but I wasn't sober. And I hit another spiritual crisis. You know, it's a great thing about my disease and higher power. You know, he's got a good sense of humor. I heard somebody say once, you know, he'll start with a whisper, and then he'll do a tap, and then he goes off and he gets a bat. You know, and I'm tired of getting beat up by that bat, I got to tell you. And it brought me back to the rooms again. But I got to a point where I was hating my life. I was stressed. I was traveling, and I was going to meetings again. And in my 11th step, the meditation meeting on Sunday mornings I go to, we meditate, and we chant beforehand, and we do a meditation for 20 minutes. It was good. And I kept getting this pulse or this sort of message. You know, the 11th step is really about asking higher power's will for us, and the power to carry that out. I kept getting tugged. You know, HP said, you know, your life is miserable in this area for a reason, because you need to be somewhere else, you know? And I was very reluctant to go there. I had, you know, all these prizes, I guess, from this new life that HP and these rooms and had given me. But I was being drawn back into prisons, you know. And I kept getting this message saying, you know, you need to write about it. You know, it was very clear. I saw some telepsychic, John Edwards on TV, you know. He'd always come out and there'd be a galley of people and he'd come out there and he'd say, okay, I'm coming over here. And then he'd start channeling and sure enough, in this area, there'd be somebody that, you know, these details he was throwing out, it was kind of like that for me. You know, it was like I just kept getting pulled over here saying, you got to do this. And I remember actually sitting outside of my therapist's office, writing in my journal about this, saying, you know, it's becoming clearer and clearer that this is what I need to be doing, but I'm frightened and I'm not sure. And, you know, what do you mean I'm supposed to write? You know, I've never written before, and I don't, you know I have a story, but, and then I said, you know, God, I'd like to do it. I need help getting started. And I swear, on my way home, I swear to God, in fact, I shared this that Sunday at my meditation meeting. On that way home, there was this kooky lady standing on the corner hitchhiking, and I pulled over, and, you know, it was in East Hampton. You don't see hitchhikers in East Hampton, right? So I picked her up, and she's chatting a mile a minute, and as we're driving, she says, you know, what do you think I do? I says, well, I don't know. She says, well, take a guess. I was like, I don't know, you're a therapist? She says, no, I'm a teacher. And I says, you know, I was going to say that. And she says, a lot of people do that. And I go, what do you teach? She says, writing. And then she volunteered. She says, I tell you what, for giving me a ride, I'll give you 3 free lessons. And I took them. And someone in the room, Big Hair Lynn, if some of you guys might know her from this area, she got me into a writer's workshop. And, you know, it was like I got to this place where it was like, okay, I give up, I'll do it. And I went back to prison, and I wrote about what happened to this 17-year-old kid, this kid from an alcoholic family, the drunk that couldn't see beyond a drink. And I finished that book, and miraculously it was published. And I released it, or it got released through publisher a couple months ago, and I've been out promoting it. And, you know, it's been amazing. I'll never make what it cost me to do it, because I quit my job, and I just did it, because it's what my higher power said I had to do, share my experience, strength, and hope. It's what I've learned how to do in these rooms, which is be of service to others. What the promises tell us that you know, we'll no longer regret the past, nor wish to close the door on it. That no matter how far down the path we may have gone, others can benefit from that service. And so I've done that. I've been to Harvard, Columbia, Howard, American, UCLA. I've been to jails. I'm delighted to hear that this group sponsors 28 meetings a month at Rikers Island. You know, we have 2.2 million prisoners in this country, more than any other country in the world. And this is an astonishing number. 13.5 million people passed through the criminal justice system last year. And if you talk to anybody in corrections, they'll tell you that 95% of them have alcohol and drug problems. Our prisons and jails are the world's largest rehabs without a treatment plan. And my higher power has taken me back there. I was in a jail in San Francisco. Actually, the sheriff, Mike Hennessy, sent his chief of staff to come pick me and Barbara up from my home group. She came out with me. And, you know, I had the privilege of speaking in front of a group of inmates there. And the guys asked me, what was my first step in dealing with the trauma of my sexual abuse? And I said, the first step was getting sober. And it absolutely was. The first step for a whole new life for me was getting sober. 19 years ago, when I walked into the mustard seed and on my sixth day when I came here and pounded the table and the people took me to those other meetings. There's nothing in my life that I can't draw a line back to these rooms. Nothing. Even my partner tomorrow will have 14 years. I met him at a Roundup dance. And we've been together 14 years, and I love him very much. And he's sober. When I met him, he had 5 years. I had 5 years. We were both in therapy, and I thought, oh. Gave us a lot of hope, I got to tell you. You know, that's two amazing sets of tools to, you know, build a relationship. Because so much of the work that we do is about, you know, relationships with ourselves, with God, and another human being, you know? I wouldn't have gotten any of these lessons in my family of origin. And the rooms of AA are are my family, you know? This is my family. This is home for me. And I hope you like what you're doing with me, because it's pretty amazing, you know? It's an amazing life. So thank you for my sobriety, and thank you for letting me speak tonight.